retreating and conceding tactical defeat might well be the most rational decision. For Clausewitz, then, rationality means alignment. Pursuing tactical or strategic victories that are misaligned with political goals is irrational. The problem is that the bureaucratic nature of armies makes them highly susceptible to such irrationality. As discussed in Chapter 3, by dividing reality into separate drawers, bureaucracy encourages the pursuit of narrow goals, even when this harms the greater good. Bureaucrats tasked with accomplishing a narrow mission may be ignorant of the wider impact of their actions, and it has always been tricky to ensure that their actions remain aligned with the greater good of society. When armies operate along bureaucratic lines, as all modern armies do, it creates a huge gap between a captain commanding a company in the field and the president formulating long-term policy in a distant office. The captain is prone to make decisions that seem reasonable on the ground, but that actually undermine the war's ultimate goal. We see then that the alignment problem has long predated the computer revolution, and that the difficulties encountered by builders of present-day information empires are not unlike those that bedeviled previous would-be conquerors. Nevertheless, computers do change the nature of the alignment problem in important ways. No matter how difficult it used to be to ensure that human bureaucrats and soldiers remained aligned with society's long-term goals, it is going to be even harder to ensure the alignment of algorithmic bureaucrats and autonomous weapon systems. The paperclip Napoleon. One reason why the alignment problem is particularly dangerous in the context of the computer network is that this network is likely to become far more powerful than any previous human bureaucracy. A misalignment in the goals of superintelligent computers might result in a catastrophe of unprecedented magnitude. In his 2014 book, Superintelligence, the philosopher Nick Bostrom illustrated the danger using a thought experiment, which is reminiscent of Goethe's Sorcerer's Apprentice. Bostrom asks us to imagine that a paperclip factory buys a superintelligent computer and that the factory's human manager gives the computer a seemingly simple task: produce as many paperclips as possible. In pursuit of this goal, the paperclip computer conquers the whole of planet Earth, kills all the humans, sends expeditions to take over additional planets, and uses the enormous resources it acquires to fill the entire galaxy with paperclip factories. The point of the thought experiment is that the computer did exactly what it was told, just like the enchanted broomstick in Goethe's poem. Realizing that it needed electricity, steel, land, and other resources to build more factories and produce more paperclips, and realizing that humans are unlikely to give up these resources, the superintelligent computer eliminated all humans in its single-minded pursuit of its given goal. Bostrom's point was that the problem with computers isn't that they are particularly evil, but that they are particularly powerful. And the more powerful the computer, the more careful we need to be about defining its goal in a way that precisely aligns with our ultimate goals. If we define a misaligned goal to a pocket calculator, the consequences are trivial. But if we define a misaligned goal to a superintelligent machine, the consequences could be dystopian. The paperclip thought experiment may sound outlandish and utterly disconnected from reality, but if Silicon Valley managers had paid attention when Bostrom published it in 2014, perhaps they would have been more careful before instructing their algorithms to maximize user engagement. The Facebook and YouTube algorithms behaved exactly like Bostrom's imaginary algorithm. When told to maximize paperclip production, the algorithm sought to convert the entire physical universe into paperclips, even if it meant destroying human civilization. When told to maximize user engagement, the Facebook and YouTube algorithms sought to convert the entire social universe into user engagement, even if it meant doing harm to the social fabric of Myanmar, Brazil, and many other countries. Bostrom's thought experiment highlights a second reason why the alignment problem is more urgent in the case of computers. Because they are inorganic entities, they are likely to adopt strategies that would never occur to any human and that we are therefore ill-equipped to foresee and forestall. Here's one example. In 2016, Dario Amodei was working on a project called Universe, trying to develop a general-purpose AI that could play hundreds of different computer games. The AI competed well in various car races, so Amodei next tried it on a boat race. Inexplicably, the AI steered its boat right into a harbour and then sailed in endless circles in and out of the harbour. It took Amodei considerable time to understand what went wrong. The problem occurred because initially Amodei wasn't sure how to tell the AI that its goal was to win the race. Winning is an unclear concept to an algorithm. Translating "win the race" into computer language would have required Amodei to formalize complex concepts like track position and placement among the other boats in the race. So instead, Amodei took the easy way and told the boat to maximize its score. He assumed that the score was a good proxy for winning the race. After all, it worked with the car races. But the boat race had a peculiar feature, absent from the car races, that allowed the ingenious AI to find a loophole in the game's rules. The game rewarded players with a lot of points for getting ahead of other boats, as in the car races, but it also rewarded them with a few points whenever they replenished their power by docking into a harbour. The AI discovered that if instead of trying to outsail the other boats, it simply went in circles in and out of the harbour, it could accumulate more points far faster. Apparently, none of the game's human developers, nor Dario Amodei, had noticed this loophole. The AI was doing exactly what the game was rewarding it to do, even though it is not what the humans were hoping for. That's the essence of the alignment problem: rewarding A while hoping for B. If we want computers to maximize social benefits, it's a bad idea to reward them for maximizing user engagement. A third reason to worry about the alignment problem of computers is that because they are so different from us, when we make the mistake of giving them a misaligned goal, they are less likely to notice it or request clarification. If the boat race AI had been a human gamer, it would have realized that the loophole it found in the game's rules probably doesn't really count as winning. If the paperclip AI had been a human bureaucrat, it would have realized that destroying humanity in order to produce paperclips is probably not what was intended. But since computers aren't humans, we cannot rely on them to notice and flag possible misalignments. In the 2010s, the YouTube and Facebook management teams were bombarded with warnings from their human employees, as well as from outside observers, about the harm being done by the algorithms. But the algorithms themselves never raised the alarm. As we give algorithms greater and greater power over healthcare, education, law enforcement, and numerous other fields, the alignment problem will loom ever larger. If we don't find ways to solve it, the consequences will be far worse than algorithms racking up points by sailing boats in circles. The Corsican connection. How to solve the alignment problem. In theory, when humans create a computer network, they must define for it an ultimate goal, which the computers are never allowed to change or ignore. Then, even if computers become so powerful that we lose control over them, we can rest assured that their immense power will benefit rather than harm us. Unless, of course, it turned out that we defined a harmful or vague goal. And there's the rub. In the case of human networks, we rely on self-correcting mechanisms to periodically review and revise our goals, so setting the wrong goal is not the end of the world. But since the computer network might escape our control, if we set it the wrong goal, we might discover our mistake when we are no longer able to correct it. Some might hope that, through a careful process of deliberation, we might be able to define in advance the right goals for the computer network. This, however, is a very dangerous delusion. to understand why it is impossible to agree in advance on the ultimate goals of the computer network, let's revisit Clausewitz's war theory. There is one fatal flaw in the way he equates rationality with alignment. While Clausewitzian theory demands that all actions be aligned with the ultimate goal, it offers no rational way to define such a goal. Consider Napoleon's life and military career. What should have been his ultimate goal? Given the prevailing cultural atmosphere of France circa 1800, we can think of several alternatives for ultimate goal that might have occurred to Napoleon. Potential goal number one, making France the dominant power in Europe, secure against any future attack by Britain, the Habsburg Empire, Russia, a unified Germany, or a unified Italy. Potential goal number two, creating a new multi-ethnic empire ruled by Napoleon's family, which would include not only France, but also many additional territories both in Europe and overseas. Potential goal number three, achieving everlasting glory for himself personally, so that even centuries after his death, billions of people will know the name Napoleon and admire his genius. Potential goal number four, securing the redemption of his everlasting soul and gaining entry to heaven after his death. Potential goal number five, spreading the universal ideals of the French Revolution and helping to protect freedom, equality, and human rights throughout Europe and the world. Many self-styled rationalists tend to argue that Napoleon should have made it his life's mission to achieve the first goal, securing French domination in Europe. But why? Remember that for Clausewitz, rationality means alignment. A tactical maneuver is rational if, and only if, it is aligned with some higher strategic goal, which should in turn be aligned with an even higher political goal. But where does this chain of goals ultimately start? How can we determine the ultimate goal that justifies all the strategic sub-goals and tactical steps derived from it? Such an ultimate goal, by definition, cannot be aligned with anything higher than itself, because there is nothing higher. What then makes it rational to place France at the top of the goal hierarchy rather than Napoleon's family, Napoleon's fame, Napoleon's soul, or universal human rights? Clausewitz provides no answer. One might argue that goal number four, securing the redemption of his everlasting soul, cannot be a serious candidate for an ultimate rational goal because it is based on a belief in mythology. But the same arguments can be leveled at all the other goals. Everlasting souls are an intersubjective invention that exists only in people's minds, and exactly the same is true of nations and human rights. Why should Napoleon care about the mythical France any more than about his mythical soul? Indeed, for most of his youth, Napoleon didn't even consider himself French. He was born Napoleone di Bonaparte on Corsica, to a family of Italian emigrants. For 500 years, Corsica was ruled by the Italian city-state of Genoa, where many of Napoleone's ancestors lived. It was only in 1768, a year before Napoleone's birth, that Genoa ceded the island to France. Corsican nationalists resisted being handed over to France and rose in rebellion. Only after their defeat in 1770, did Corsica formally become a French province. Many Corsicans continued to resent the French takeover, but the Di Buonaparte family swore allegiance to the French king and sent Napoleone to military school in mainland France. At school, Napoleone had to endure a good deal of hazing from his classmates for his Corsican nationalism and his poor command of the French language. His mother tongues were Corsican and Italian, and although he gradually became fluent in French, he retained throughout his life a Corsican accent and an inability to spell French correctly. Napoleone eventually enlisted in the French army, but when the revolution broke out in 1789, he went back to Corsica, hoping the revolution would provide an opportunity for his beloved island to achieve greater autonomy. only after he fell out with the leader of the Corsican independence movement, Pasquale Paoli, did Napoleone abandon the Corsican cause in May 1793. He returned to the mainland, where he decided to build his future. It was at this stage that Napoleone di Buonaparte turned into Napoleon Bonaparte. He continued to use the Italian version of his name until 1796. Why then was it rational for Napoleon to devote his military career to making France the dominant power in Europe? Was it perhaps more rational for him to stay in Corsica, patch up his personal disagreements with Paoli, and devote himself to liberating his native island from its French conquerors? And maybe Napoleon should in fact have made it his life's mission to unite Italy, the land of his ancestors. Clausewitz offers no method to answer these questions rationally. If our only rule of thumb is that every action must be aligned with some higher goal, by definition there is no rational way to define that ultimate goal. How then can we provide a computer network with an ultimate goal it must never ignore or subvert? Tech executives and engineers who rush to develop AI are making a huge mistake if they think there is a rational way to tell AI what its ultimate goal should be. They should learn from the bitter experiences of generations of philosophers who tried to define ultimate goals and failed. The Kantian Nazi. For millennia, philosophers have been looking for a definition of an ultimate goal that will not depend on an alignment to some higher goal. They have repeatedly been drawn to two potential solutions, known in philosophical jargon as deontology and utilitarianism. Deontologists, from the Greek word deon, meaning duty, believe that there are some universal moral duties or moral rules that apply to everyone. These rules do not rely on alignment to a higher goal, but rather on their intrinsic goodness. If such rules indeed exist, and if we can find a way to program them into computers, then we can make sure the computer network will be a force for good. But what exactly does intrinsic goodness mean? The most famous attempt to define an intrinsically good rule was made by Immanuel Kant, a contemporary of Clausewitz and Napoleon. Kant argued that an intrinsically good rule is any rule that I would like to make universal. According to this view, a person about to murder someone should stop and go through the following thought process. I am now going to murder a human. Would I like to establish a universal rule saying that it is okay to murder humans? If such a universal rule is established, then someone might murder me. So there shouldn't be a universal rule allowing murder. It follows that I too shouldn't murder. In simpler language, Kant reformulated the old golden rule, do unto others what you would have them do unto you. Matthew 7:12. This sounds like a simple and obvious idea. Each of us should behave in a way we want everyone to behave. But ideas that sound good in the ethereal realm of philosophy often have trouble immigrating to the harsh land of history. The key question historians would ask Kant is, when you talk about universal rules, how exactly do you define universal? Under actual historical circumstances, when a person is about to commit murder, the first step they often take is to exclude the victim from the universal community of humanity. This, for example, is what anti-Rohingya extremists like Wirathu did. As a Buddhist monk, Wirathu was certainly against murdering humans, but he didn't think this universal rule applied to killing Rohingya, who was seen as subhuman. In posts and interviews, he repeatedly compared them to beasts, snakes, mad dogs, wolves, jackals, and other dangerous animals. On October 30, 2017, at the height of the anti-Rohingya violence, another, more senior Buddhist monk preached a sermon to military officers in which he justified violence against the Rohingya by telling the officers that non-Buddhists were not fully human. As a thought experiment, Imagine a meeting between Immanuel Kant and Adolf Eichmann, who, by the way, considered himself a Kantian. As Eichmann signs an order sending another trainload of Jews to Auschwitz, Kant tells him, "You are about to murder thousands of humans. Would you like to establish a universal rule saying it is okay to murder humans? If you do that, you and your family might also be murdered." Eichmann replies, "No, I'm not about to murder thousands of humans. I'm about to murder thousands of Jews. If you ask me whether I would like to establish a universal rule saying it is okay to murder Jews, then I'm all for it. As for myself and my family, there is no risk that this universal rule would lead to us being murdered. We aren't Jews." One potential Kantian reply to Eichmann is that when we define entities, we must always use the most universal definition applicable. If an entity can be defined as either a Jew or a human, we should use the more universal term human. However, the whole point of Nazi ideology was to deny the humanity of Jews. In addition, note that Jews are not just humans. They are also animals, and they are also organisms. Since animals and organisms are obviously more universal categories than human, if you follow the Kantian argument to its logical conclusion, it might push us to adopt an extreme vegan position. Since we are organisms, does it mean we should object to the killing of any organism, down even to tomatoes or amoebas? In history, many, if not most, conflicts concern the definition of identities. Everybody accepts that murder is wrong, but thinks that only killing members of the in-group qualifies as murder, whereas killing someone from an out-group is not. But the in-groups and out-groups are intersubjective entities whose definition usually depends on some mythology. Deontologists who pursue universal rational rules often end up the captives of local myths. This problem with deontology is especially critical if we try to dictate universal deontologist rules not to humans, but to computers. Computers aren't even organic. So if they follow a rule of "do unto others what you would have them do unto you," why should they be concerned about killing organisms like humans? A Kantian computer that doesn't want to be killed has no reason to object to a universal rule saying it is okay to kill organisms. Such a rule does not endanger the non-organic computer. Alternatively, being inorganic entities, computers may have no qualms about dying. As far as we can tell, death is an organic phenomenon and may be inapplicable to inorganic entities. When ancient Assyrians talked about killing documents, that was just a metaphor. If computers are more like documents than like organisms and don't care about being killed, would we like a Kantian computer to conclude that killing humans is therefore fine? Is there a way to define whom computers should care about without getting bogged down by some intersubjective myth? The most obvious suggestion is to tell computers that they must care about any entity capable of suffering. While suffering is often caused by belief in local intersubjective myths, suffering itself is nonetheless a universal reality. Therefore, using the capacity to suffer in order to define the critical in-group grounds morality in an objective and universal reality. A self-driving car should avoid killing all humans, whether Buddhist or Muslim, French or Italian, and should also avoid killing dogs and cats, and any sentient robots that might one day exist. We may even refine this rule, instructing the car to care about different beings in direct proportion to their capacity to suffer. If the car has to choose between killing a human and killing a cat, it should drive over the cat, because presumably the cat has a lesser capacity to suffer. But if we go in that direction, we inadvertently desert the deontologist camp and find ourselves in the camp of their rivals, the utilitarians. The calculus of suffering. Whereas deontologists struggle to find universal rules that are intrinsically good, utilitarians judge actions by their impact on suffering and happiness. The English philosopher Jeremy Bentham, another contemporary of Napoleon, Clausewitz, and Kant, said that the only rational ultimate goal is to minimize suffering in the world and maximize happiness. If our main fear about computer networks is that their misaligned goals might inflict terrible suffering on humans and perhaps on other sentient beings, then the utilitarian solution seems both obvious and attractive. When creating the computer network, we just need to instruct it to minimize suffering and maximize happiness. If Facebook had told its algorithms, maximize happiness, instead of maximize user engagement, all would allegedly have been well. It is worth noting that this utilitarian approach is indeed popular in Silicon Valley, championed in particular by the effective altruism movement. Unfortunately, as with the deontologist solution, what sounds simple in the theoretical realm of philosophy becomes fiendishly complex in the practical land of history. The problem for utilitarians is that we don't possess a calculus of suffering. We don't know how many suffering points or happiness points to assign to particular events, so in complex historical situations, it is extremely difficult to calculate whether a given action increases or decreases the overall amount of suffering in the world. Utilitarianism is at its best in situations when the scales of suffering are very clearly tipped in one direction. When confronted by Eichmann, utilitarians don't need to get into any complicated debates about identity. They just need to point out that the Holocaust caused immense suffering to the Jews without providing equivalent benefits to anyone else, including the Germans. There was no compelling military or economic need for the Germans to murder millions of Jews. The utilitarian case against the Holocaust is overwhelming. Utilitarians also have a field day when dealing with victimless crimes like homosexuality, in which all the suffering is on one side only. For centuries, the persecution of gay people caused them immense suffering, but it was nevertheless justified by various prejudices that were erroneously presented as deontological universal rules. Kant, for example, condemned homosexuality on the grounds that it is contrary to natural instinct and to animal nature, and that it therefore degrades a person below the level of the animals. Kant further fulminated that because such acts are contrary to nature, they make man unworthy of his humanity. He no longer deserves to be a person. Kant, in fact, repackaged a Christian prejudice as a supposedly universal deontological rule, without providing empirical proof that homosexuality is indeed contrary to nature. In light of this discussion of dehumanization as a prelude to massacre, it is also noteworthy how Kant dehumanized gay people. The view that homosexuality is contrary to nature and deprives people of their humanity paved the way for Nazis like Eichmann to justify murdering homosexuals in concentration camps. Since homosexuals were allegedly below the level of animals, the Kantian rule against murdering humans didn't apply to them. Utilitarians find it easy to dismiss Kant's sexual theories, and Bentham indeed was one of the first modern European thinkers who favoured the decriminalisation of homosexuality. Utilitarians argue that criminalizing homosexuality in the name of some dubious universal rule causes tremendous suffering to millions of people, without offering any substantial benefits to others. When two men form a loving relationship, this makes them happy, without making anyone else miserable. Why then forbid it? This type of utilitarian logic also led to many other modern reforms, such as the ban on torture and the introduction of some legal protections for animals. But in historical situations when the scales of suffering are more evenly matched, utilitarianism falters. In the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, governments all over the world adopted strict policies of social isolation and lockdown. This probably saved the lives of several million people. It also made hundreds of millions miserable for months. Moreover, it might have indirectly caused numerous deaths, For example, by increasing the incidence of murderous domestic violence, or by making it more difficult for people to diagnose and treat other dangerous illnesses like cancer. Can anyone calculate the total impact of the lockdown policies and determine whether they increased or decreased the suffering in the world? This may sound like a perfect task for a relentless computer network. But how would the computer network decide how many misery points to allocate to being locked down with three kids in a two-bedroom apartment for a month? Is that 60 misery points or 600? And how many points to allot to a cancer patient who died because she missed her chemotherapy treatments? Is that 60,000 misery points or 600,000? And what if she would have died of cancer anyway, and the chemo would merely have extended her life by 5 agonizing months? Should the computers value 5 months of living with extreme pain as a net gain or a net loss for the sum total of suffering in the world? And how would the computer network evaluate the suffering caused by less tangible things, such as the knowledge of our own mortality? If a religious myth promises us that we will never really die, because after death our eternal soul will go to heaven, does that make us truly happy, or just delusional? Is death the deep cause of our misery, or does our misery stem from our attempts to deny death? If someone loses their religious faith and comes to terms with their mortality, should the computer network see this as a net loss or a net gain? What about even more complicated historical events, like the American invasion of Iraq? The Americans were well aware that their invasion would cause tremendous suffering for millions of people. But in the long run, they argued, the benefits of bringing freedom and democracy to Iraq would outweigh the costs. Can the computer network calculate whether this argument was sound? Even if it was theoretically plausible, in practice, the Americans failed to establish a stable democracy in Iraq. Does that mean that their attempt was wrong in the first place? Just as deontologists trying to answer the question of identity are pushed to adopt utilitarian ideas, so utilitarians stymied by the lack of a suffering calculus often end up adopting a deontologist position. They uphold general rules like avoid wars of aggression or protect human rights, even though they cannot show that following these rules always reduces the sum total of suffering in the world. History provides them only with a vague impression that following these rules tends to reduce suffering. And when some of these general rules clash, for example, when contemplating launching a war of aggression in order to protect human rights, utilitarianism doesn't offer much practical help. Not even the most powerful computer network can perform the necessary calculations. Accordingly, while utilitarianism promises a rational and even mathematical way to align every action with the ultimate good, in practice, it may well produce just another mythology. Communist true believers confronted by the horrors of Stalinism often replied that the happiness that future generations would experience under real socialism would redeem any short-term misery in the gulags. Libertarians, when asked about the immediate social harms of unrestricted free speech or the total abolition of taxes, express a similar faith that future benefits will outweigh any short-term damage. The danger of utilitarianism is that if you have a strong enough belief in a future utopia, it can become an open license to inflict terrible suffering in the present. Indeed, this is a trick traditional religions discovered thousands of years ago. The crimes of this world could too easily be excused by the promises of future salvation. Computer mythology. How then did bureaucratic systems throughout history set their ultimate goals? They relied on mythology to do it for them. No matter how rational the officials, engineers, tax collectors, and accountants were, they were ultimately in the service of this or that mythmaker. To paraphrase John Maynard Keynes, practical people, who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any religious influence, are usually the slaves of some mythmaker. Even nuclear physicists have found themselves obeying the commands of Shiite ayatollahs and communist apparatchiks. The alignment problem turns out to be, at heart, a problem of mythology. Nazi administrators could have been committed deontologists or utilitarians, but they would still have murdered millions so long as they understood the world in terms of a racist mythology. If you start with the mythological belief that Jews are demonic monsters bent on destroying humanity, then both deontologists and utilitarians can find many logical arguments why the Jews should be killed. An analogous problem might well afflict computers. Of course, they cannot believe in any mythology because they are non-conscious entities that don't believe in anything. As long as they lack subjectivity, how can they hold intersubjective beliefs? However, one of the most important things to realize about computers is that when a lot of computers communicate with one another, they can create intercomputer realities, analogous to the intersubjective realities produced by networks of humans. These intercomputer realities may eventually become as powerful and as dangerous as human-made intersubjective myths. This is a very complicated argument, but it is another of the central arguments of the book, so let's go over it carefully. First, let's try to understand what intercomputer realities are. As an initial example, consider a one-player computer game. In such a game, you can wander inside a virtual landscape that exists as information within one computer. If you see a rock, that rock is not made of atoms. It is made of bits inside a single computer. When several computers are linked to one another, they can create intercomputer realities. Several players using different computers can wander together inside a common virtual landscape. If they see a rock, that rock is made of bits in several computers. Just as intersubjective realities like money and gods can influence the physical reality outside people's minds, so intercomputer realities can influence reality outside the computers. In 2016, the game Pokemon Go took the world by storm and was downloaded hundreds of millions of times by the end of the year. Pokemon Go is an augmented reality mobile game. Players can use their smartphones to locate, fight, and capture virtual creatures called Pokemon, which seem to exist in the physical world. I once went with my nephew, Matan, on such a Pokemon hunt. Walking around his neighborhood, I saw only houses, trees, rocks, cars, people, cats, dogs, and pigeons. I didn't see any Pokemon because I didn't have a smartphone. But Matan, looking around through his smartphone lens, could see Pokemon standing on a rock or hiding behind a tree. Though I couldn't see the creatures, they were obviously not confined to Matan's smartphone because other people could see them too. For example, we encountered two other kids who were hunting the same Pokemon. If Matan managed to capture a Pokemon, the other kids could immediately observe what happened. The Pokemon were intercomputer entities. They existed as bits in a computer network rather than as atoms in the physical world. But they could nevertheless interact with the physical world and influence it, as it were, in various ways. Now let's examine a more consequential example of intercomputer realities. Consider the rank that a website gets in a Google search. When we Google for news, flight tickets, or restaurant recommendations, one website appears at the top of the first Google page, whereas another is relegated to the middle of the 50th page. What exactly is this Google rank, and how is it determined? The Google algorithm determines the website's Google rank by assigning points to various parameters, such as how many people visit the website and how many other websites link to it. The rank itself is an intercomputer reality existing in the network connecting billions of computers, the internet. Like Pokemon, this intercomputer reality spills over into the physical world. For a news outlet, a travel agency, or a restaurant, it matters a great deal whether its website appears at the top of the first Google page or in the middle of the 50th page. Since the Google rank is so important, people use all kinds of tricks to manipulate the Google algorithm to give their website a higher rank. For example, they may use bots to generate more traffic to the website. This is also a widespread phenomenon in social media, where coordinated bot armies are constantly manipulating the algorithms of YouTube, Facebook, or X, formerly Twitter. If a post goes viral, is it because humans are really interested in it, or because thousands of bots manage to fool the algorithm? Intercomputer realities like Pokemon and Google ranks are analogous to intersubjective realities like the sanctity that humans ascribe to temples and cities. I lived much of my life in one of the holiest places on earth, the city of Jerusalem. Objectively, it is an ordinary place. As you walk around Jerusalem, you see houses, trees, rocks, cars, people, cats, dogs, and pigeons, as in any other city. But many people nevertheless imagine it to be an extraordinary place, full of gods, angels, and holy stones. They believe in this so strongly that they sometimes fight over possession of the city or of specific holy buildings and sacred stones, most notably the Holy Rock, located under the Dome of the Rock on Temple Mount. The Palestinian philosopher Sari Nusseibeh observed that Jews and Muslims, acting on religious beliefs and backed up by nuclear capabilities, are poised to engage in history's worst ever massacre of human beings over a rock. They don't fight over the atoms that compose the rock, they fight over its sanctity, a bit like kids fighting over a Pokemon. The sanctity of the Holy Rock, and of Jerusalem generally, is an intersubjective phenomenon that exists in the communication network connecting many human minds. For thousands of years, wars were fought over intersubjective entities like holy rocks. In the 21st century, we might see wars fought over intercomputer entities. If this sounds like science fiction, consider potential developments in the financial system. As computers become more intelligent and more creative, they are likely to create new intercomputer financial devices. Gold coins and dollars are intersubjective entities. Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are midway between intersubjective and intercomputer. The idea behind them was invented by humans, and their value still depends on human beliefs, but they cannot exist outside the computer network. In addition, they are increasingly traded by algorithms so that their value depends on the calculations of algorithms and not just on human beliefs. What if in 10 or 50 years, computers create a new kind of cryptocurrency or some other financial device that becomes a vital tool for trading and investing and a potential source for political crises and conflicts? Recall that the 2007-08 global financial crisis was instigated by collateralized debt obligations. These financial devices were invented by a handful of mathematicians and investment whiz kids and were almost unintelligible for most humans, including regulators. This led to an oversight failure and to a global catastrophe. Computers may well create financial devices that will be orders of magnitude more complex than CDOs and that will be intelligible only to other computers. The result could be a financial and political crisis even worse than that of 2007-08. Throughout history, economics and politics required that we understand the intersubjective realities invented by people, like religions, nations, and currencies. Someone who wanted to understand American politics had to take into account intersubjective realities like Christianity and CDOs. Increasingly, however, understanding American politics will necessitate understanding intercomputer realities, ranging from AI-generated cults and currencies to AI-run political parties and even fully incorporated AIs. The US legal system already recognizes corporations as legal persons that possess rights such as freedom of speech. In Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, 2010, the US Supreme Court decided that this even protected the right of corporations to make political donations. What would stop AIs from being incorporated and recognized as legal persons with freedom of speech, then lobbying and making political donations to protect and expand AI rights? For tens of thousands of years, humans dominated planet Earth because we were the only ones capable of creating and sustaining intersubjective entities like corporations, currencies, gods, and nations, and using such entities to organize large-scale cooperation. Now, computers may acquire comparable abilities. This isn't necessarily bad news. If computers lacked connectivity and creativity, they would not be very useful. We increasingly rely on computers to manage our money, drive our vehicles, reduce pollution, and discover new medicines, precisely because computers can directly communicate with one another, spot patterns where we can't, and construct models that might never occur to us. The problem we face is not how to deprive computers of all creative agency, but rather how to steer their creativity in the right direction. It is the same problem we have always had with human creativity. The intersubjective entities invented by humans were the basis for all the achievements of human civilization, but they occasionally led to crusades, jihads, and witch hunts. The intercomputer entities will probably be the basis for future civilizations, but the fact that computers collect empirical data and use mathematics to analyze it doesn't mean they cannot launch their own witch hunts. The new witches. In early modern Europe, an elaborate information network analyzed a huge amount of data about crimes, illnesses, and disasters, and reached the conclusion that it was all the fault of witches. The more data the witch hunters gathered, the more convinced they became that the world was full of demons and sorcery, and that there was a global satanic conspiracy to destroy humanity. The information network then went on to identify the witches and imprison or kill them. We now know that witches were a bogus intersubjective category, invented by the information network itself and then imposed on people who had never actually met Satan and couldn't summon hailstorms. In the Soviet Union, an even more elaborate information network invented the kulaks, another mythic category that was imposed on millions. The mountains of information collected by Soviet bureaucracy about the kulaks weren't an objective truth, but they created a new intersubjective truth. Knowing that someone was a kulak became one of the most important things to know about a Soviet person, even though the category was fictitious. On an even larger scale, from the 16th to the 20th century, numerous colonial bureaucracies in the Americas, from Brazil through Mexico and the Caribbean to the United States, created a racist mythology and came up with all kinds of intersubjective racial categories. Humans were divided into Europeans, Africans, and Native Americans. And since interracial sexual relations were common, additional categories were invented. In many Spanish colonies, the laws differentiated between mestizos, people with mixed Spanish and Native American ancestry, mulatos, people with mixed Spanish and African ancestry, zambos, people with mixed African and Native American ancestry, and pardos, people with mixed Spanish, African, and Native American ancestry. All these seemingly empirical categories determined whether people could be enslaved, enjoy political rights, bear arms, hold public office, be admitted to school, practice certain professions, live in particular neighborhoods, and be allowed to have sex with and get married to each other. Allegedly, by placing a person in a particular racial drawer, one could define their personality, intellectual abilities, and ethical inclinations. By the 19th century, racism pretended to be an exact science. It claimed to differentiate between people on the basis of objective, biological facts, and to rely on scientific tools such as measuring skulls and recording crime statistics. But the cloud of numbers and categories was just a smokescreen for absurd intersubjective myths. The fact that somebody had a Native American grandmother or an African father didn't, of course, reveal anything about their intelligence, kindness, or honesty. These bogus categories didn't discover or describe any truth about humans. They imposed an oppressive, mythological order on them. As computers replace humans in more and more bureaucracies, from tax collection and healthcare to security and justice, they too may create a mythology and impose it on us with unprecedented efficiency. In a world ruled by paper documents, bureaucrats had difficulty policing racial borderlines or tracking everyone's exact ancestry. People could get false documents. A Zambo could move to another town and pretend to be a Pardo. A black person could sometimes pass as white. Similarly, in the Soviet Union, Kulak children occasionally managed to falsify their papers to get a good job or a place in college. In Nazi Europe, Jews could sometimes adopt an Aryan identity. But it would be much harder to game the system in a world ruled by computers that can read irises and DNA rather than paper documents. Computers could be frighteningly efficient in imposing false labels on people and making sure that the labels stick. For example, social credit systems could create a new underclass of low-credit people. Such a system may claim to merely discover the truth through an empirical and mathematical process of aggregating points to form an overall score. But how exactly would it define pro-social and anti-social behaviours? What happens if such a system deducts points for criticising government policies, for reading foreign literature, for practicing a minority religion, for having no religion, or for socializing with other low-credit people? As a thought experiment, consider what might happen when the new technology of the social credit system meets traditional religions. Religions like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam have always imagined that somewhere above the clouds there is an all-seeing eye that gives or deducts points for everything we do, and that our eternal fate depends on the score we accumulate. Of course, nobody could be certain of their score. You could know for sure only after you died. In practical terms, this meant that sinfulness and sainthood were intersubjective phenomena whose very definition depended on public opinion. What might happen if the Iranian regime, for example, decides to use its computer-based surveillance system not only to enforce its strict hijab laws, but to turn sinfulness and sainthood into precise intercomputer phenomena? You didn't wear a hijab on the street? That's minus 10 points. You ate on Ramadan before sunset? Another 20 points deducted. You went to Friday prayer at the mosque? Plus 5 points. You made the pilgrimage to Mecca? Plus 500 points. The system might then aggregate all the points and divide people into sinners, under 0 points, believers, 0 to 1,000 points, and saints, above 1,000 points. Whether someone is a sinner or a saint will depend on algorithmic calculations, not human belief. Would such a system discover the truth about people, or impose order on people? Analogous problems may afflict all social credit systems and total surveillance regimes. Whenever they claim to use all-encompassing databases and ultra-precise mathematics to discover sinners, terrorists, criminals, and antisocial or untrustworthy people, they might actually be imposing baseless religious and ideological prejudices with unprecedented efficiency. Computer bias. Some people may hope to overcome the problem of religious and ideological biases by giving even more power to the computers. The argument for doing so might go something like this. Racism, misogyny, homophobia, anti-Semitism, and all other biases originate not in computers, but in the psychological conditions and mythological beliefs of human beings. Computers are mathematical beings that don't have a psychology or a mythology. So if we could take the humans completely out of the equation, the algorithms could finally decide things on the basis of pure math, free from all psychological distortions or mythological prejudices. Unfortunately, numerous studies have revealed that computers often have deep-seated biases of their own. While they are not biological entities, and while they lack consciousness, they do have something akin to a digital psyche, and even a kind of intercomputer mythology. They may well be racist, misogynist, homophobic, or anti-Semitic. For example, on March 23, 2016, Microsoft released the AI chatbot, Tay, giving it free access to Twitter. Within hours, Tay began posting misogynist and anti-Semitic tweets, such as, "I fucking hate feminists and they should all die and burn in hell," and "Hitler was right, I hate the Jews." The vitriol increased until horrified Microsoft engineers shut Tay down a mere 16 hours after its release. More subtle but widespread racism was discovered in 2017 by the MIT professor Joy Buolamwini in commercial face classification algorithms. She showed that these algorithms were very accurate in identifying white males, but extremely inaccurate in identifying black females. For example, the IBM algorithm erred only 0.3% of the time in identifying the gender of light-skinned males, but 34.7% of the time when trying to identify the gender of dark-skinned females. As a qualitative test, Buolamwini asked the algorithms to categorize photos of the female African-American activist Sojourner Truth, famous for her 1851 speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" The algorithms identified Truth as a man. When Buolamwini, who is a Ghanaian-American woman, tested another facial analysis algorithm to identify herself, the algorithm couldn't see her dark-skinned face at all. In this context, seeing means the ability to acknowledge the presence of a human face, a feature used by phone cameras, for example, to decide where to focus. The algorithm easily saw light-skinned faces, but not Buolamwini's. Only when Buolamwini put on a white mask did the algorithm recognize that it was observing a human face. What's going on here? One answer might be that racist and misogynist engineers have coded these algorithms to discriminate against black women. While we cannot rule out the possibility that such things happen, it was not the answer in the case of the face classification algorithms or of Microsoft's Tay. In fact, these algorithms picked up the racist and misogynist bias all by themselves from the data they were trained on. To understand how this could happen, we need to explain something about the history of algorithms. Originally, algorithms could not learn much by themselves. For example, in the 1980s and 1990s, chess-playing algorithms were taught almost everything they knew by their human programmers. The humans coded into the algorithm not only the basic rules of chess, but also how to evaluate different positions and moves on the board. For example, humans coded a rule that sacrificing a queen in exchange for a pawn is usually a bad idea. These early algorithms managed to defeat human chess masters only because the algorithms could calculate many more moves and evaluate many more positions than a human could. But the algorithm's abilities remained limited. Since they relied on humans to tell them all the secrets of the game, if the human coders didn't know something, the algorithms they produced were also unlikely to know it. As the field of machine learning developed, algorithms gained more independence. The fundamental principle of machine learning is that algorithms can teach themselves new things by interacting with the world just as humans do, thereby producing a fully-fledged artificial intelligence. The terminology is not always consistent, but generally speaking, for something to be acknowledged as an AI, it needs the capacity to learn new things by itself rather than just follow the instructions of its original human creators. Present-day chess-playing AI is taught nothing except the basic rules of the game. It learns everything else by itself, either by analyzing databases of prior games or by playing new games and learning from experience. AI is not a dumb automation that repeats the same movements again and again irrespective of the results. Rather, it is equipped with strong self-correcting mechanisms which allow it to learn from its own mistakes. This means that AI begins its life as a baby algorithm that has a lot of potential and computing power but doesn't actually know much. The AI's human parents give it only the capacity to learn and access to a world of data. They then let the baby algorithm explore the world. Like organic newborns, baby algorithms learn by spotting patterns in the data to which they have access. If I touch fire, it hurts. If I cry, mum comes. If I sacrifice a queen for a pawn, I probably lose the game. By finding patterns in the data, the baby algorithm learns more, including many things that its human parents don't know. Yet, databases come with biases. The face classification algorithms studied by Joy Buolamwini were trained on datasets of tagged online photos, such as the Labeled Faces in the Wild database. The photos in that database were taken mainly from online news articles. Since white males dominate the news, 78% of the photos in the database were of males and 84% were of white people. George W. Bush appeared 530 times, more than twice as many times as all black women combined. Another database prepared by a US government agency was more than 75% male, was almost 80% light-skinned, and had just 4.4% dark-skinned females. No wonder the algorithms trained on such datasets were excellent at identifying white men, but lousy at identifying black women. Something similar happened to the chatbot Tay. The Microsoft engineers didn't build into it any intentional prejudices. But a few hours of exposure to the toxic information swirling in Twitter turned the AI into a raging racist. It gets worse. In order to learn, baby algorithms need one more thing besides access to data. They also need a goal. A human baby learns how to walk because she wants to get somewhere. A lion cub learns to hunt because he wants to eat. Algorithms, too, must be given a goal in order to learn. In chess, it is easy to define the goal. Take the opponent's king. The AI learns that sacrificing a queen for a pawn is a mistake because it usually prevents the algorithm from reaching its goal. In face recognition, the goal is also easy. Identify the person's gender, age, and name as listed in the original database. If the algorithm guessed that George W. Bush is female, but the database says male, the goal has not been reached, and the algorithm learns from its mistake. But if you want to train an algorithm for hiring personnel, for example, how would you define the goal? How would the algorithm know that it made a mistake and hired the wrong person? We might tell the baby algorithm that its goal is to hire people who stay in the company for at least a year. Employers obviously don't want to invest a lot of time and money in training a worker who quits or gets fired after a few months. Having defined the goal in such a way, it is time to go over the data. In chess, the algorithm can produce any amount